Access number 30283, Real 4.
Barry Priest, Real 4. Tell me about 48 Squadron.
48 Squadron, quite a historic squadron. Their badge was a red triangle with a hawk's or an eagle's head on it. And the red triangle came from the First World War when they used to mark their victories in combat with, you know, when they shot down a German aircraft, they'd stick a Bass triangle, you know, the Bass Spear. Bass Spear, their sort of trademark was a red triangle. And so, you know, they used to put a red triangle, the beer bottle label on their aircraft and that number of kills they had. And that had been incorporated into the squadron badge. So it was quite a historic squadron. We had quite a hard-line boss, but he was a good boss.
Who was that?
Bill Straker, Wing Commander Straker, ex-test pilot, small guy, quite dynamic. Nice bunch of blokes on the squadron, but Singapore in the early 60s was a great place to be, particularly as a young guy, unmarried. It was a real swinging sort of place in all senses. Still quite colonial in many ways. The squadron was a great squadron to be on because we did strategic transport and tactical transport, which meant strategic transport, we did a lot of route flying. So we got up to Hong Kong quite a lot, into the Middle East, Australia, New Zealand. I went out in the Pacific, around the Pacific Islands and things like this. So that was good fun, going to all sorts of, you know, out-of-the-way places. The supply dropping and over the jungles of Malaya, we did a lot of training, low-level flying again, which was mainly uninhabited. So as long as you were sensible and when you knew where the hospitals were and the odd settlement was, you could really enjoy your low flying. And the Borneo flying again, we're actually doing a sort of a proper operational job, was enormous fun. It's quite interesting because having chatted to Roger about your interview with him and things, and he was saying he was terrified of this, but he'd had a particular incident which he probably told you about when he came very close to going in when the dinghy came out and affected the Argosy. So he got a bit nervous about flying from that, whereas I was too stupid probably to realise that, you know, what we were doing, why we were doing it was okay, why you had four engines working was okay, but at the wrong time in the wrong place, if one of the engines stopped working, then you could have been in dire problems. But it just never occurred to me. You know, it was just enormous fun, low flying, you know, across the mountains and the jungles and trying to find this very small DZ to drop stuff into, and then doing a number of circuits dropping stuff off. It was just great sport, and we were quite lucky because we used to go back to Kuching, and in the evenings, for some reason, 48 Squadron, we stayed downtown in an air conditioned room, which I didn't have an air conditioned room at Changi. So it was just wonderful. And
I'm going to slow it down a little.
Right,
bit.
Sorry, yes, I'm rushing off.
No,
yes.
That's useful because it's a useful survey. But I was just going to take you back and just wonder, just to go back to sort of day one, you just arrived.
Yes.
You joined 48 Squadron. What can you describe the base for me?
Yeah.
Can you give me a picture of the base? Because I don't.
One long runway, running basically north south. There's a cross runway, which is not used anymore. And the story is that the Japanese made the British prisoners of war build it in during the war, so they built it out of wind, you know, to just try and make life difficult for the Japanese. But on the east side of that runway, there are two squadrons, the Argosy Squadron and the Shackleton. So there are two buildings over that side with a dispersal for their aeroplanes. On the other side, on the west side of the runway, more in towards the centre of towards the island, centre of the island, was 48 Squadron and Far East Comm dispersals, with again Hastings parked on there. The squadron buildings, as I said, for 205 and 215 are on that east side. We are on the north south runway. We're going up towards the north end on the northwest side. There's an old building up there, which is oblong, two-storey, with big verandas along the front, lots of the Far East buildings. The boss's office and the various offices along the top, crew room down the bottom, air-conditioned crew room, it's about the only place that is air-conditioned. Then just beyond that there's a flight of with a target towing flight of Meteors, which obviously operate with the guys from Tinga. But why they're based there, I don't know, but they are. They're based there. And then going further north, on the northwest side, there's Changi Village. The main street, each side, shops, not them open-fronted shops. Endless tailors, because everybody's having their uniforms made there. We don't use issue uniforms, you have them made there. Electronic shops, shops selling silks and clothes, Noritake China shops, all this sort of thing. But real old-fashioned Eastern-type shops. And it's quite a buzzing place. I remember walking through Changi Village once. In fact, I was with Dorothy, and we walked past the bakers, which was halfway down. And when I say the bakers, I mean the actual place where they make the bread. And looking in there, and there was this vast mound of dough on a stainless steel table. And I thought, that's a lot of currant bread to make. And then somebody walked in, and all the flies, you know, get airborne off the bread. So yes, it was. Street sellers with food, so in the evenings you go down there, you sit at a stall and have a lovely Chinese meal for next to nothing. Armour's market once a week, you know, with all the stalls, they'd all come in and set up their stalls selling everything, records, clothes, food, whatever you like. And it was just and then the station administrative buildings, there was a big sports field, two big sports fields, a golf course, and a nine-hole golf course there. There was a transit hotel, a RAF-run transit hotel, because obviously a lot of passengers coming and going all the time, because it was the main transport base for the Far East. During confrontation with Indonesia, of course, there were a lot of people out there, about 50,000 people out there, with Dorothy taught in the Changi Junior School, where they had 1,100 pupils between 7 and 11. So it was a big place, a lot going on. There was a band concert room, you know, where they rehearsal room, and just everything you could think of was there. And
you said just a little bit earlier, you said, you know, you don't wear your issued uniform, you go and get one made. Why was that?
Because it was cheap and they were so much nicer and so much better. And in fact, before I went out to Singapore with a couple of the guys I went out with, we'd gone and got a sort of a mixture of a khaki shirt and a pair of khaki trousers, so that we. But when you got out there, they were so awful with the stuff you could buy, this locally made stuff, and of course they were onto it. Like, you know, they had all the materials that you could want for the uniforms you could want, and I think I can't absolutely remember. I think we got a uniform allowance to equip ourselves.
So what would you wear on a typical day?
Typical day. Very lightweight, short sleeve khaki shirt and shorts.
And shoes?
Yeah, just ordinary black, the Oxford shoes that you're supposed to wear. Yes, you still haven't got to the stage then of having decent hot weather footwear at that stage. Bush jackets we had, which were quite nice. And you could have what they call a number six, which is the full dress uniform. I was quite lucky because I arrived there at the same time as another guy who had a number six uniform, an older guy. He got himself a number six uniform, but I don't think he ever wore it. I think I wore it for him about three times because he was my size. Because one was, in fact, it was quite, again, you're talking about doing different things. One of the jobs I got very early on was to go to, because we arrived in October, it must have been that Armistice Day. And we went, I had been in charge of a detachment from the squadron that went to the Kranji War Cemetery, which is the most beautiful and very moving place, you know, where all the prisoners and people who died. It's a war graves commission place. and we went there for the armistice, and I wore his number 6 for that. And so yes, I was invited at one stage to a dinner or a lunch up at the FIAF headquarters mess, and I wore it there for that. But I'm not sure he ever wore it. And what was more, when I got promoted to front, so did he. So it was had the right rank on it next time I wore it. So. So, but basically, it's shorts and shirts, and or a bush jacket and long trousers. And
where were you living at this point? What was the accommodation like?
Temple Hill mess, which, as the name suggests, was on a hill. And again, it was one of these big square rectangular buildings. It had been an artillery mess pre-war, and big verandas, all very very open. And dining room, anterooms, some bedrooms upstairs, and I stayed in that bedroom. I stayed in one of the upstairs bedrooms for a couple of months, because spread round the base of the hill, or halfway down the hill, in fact, were a number of huts or accommodation blocks, single story, bedrooms each side with bathrooms in the middle. And there are probably about half a dozen of those in which the guys stayed, and there was one for the WAFs where the WAFs stayed, and Dorothy in fact was living at that time. Yeah, it was a nice place, you know, obviously very lots of evenings in the bar, and lots of evenings though in Singapore, and played a lot of sport there. Of course, there was a sports competition between the squadrons, so you know, always playing all sorts of sports, and it was just a good place to be.
Was there much training? Were you?
Yeah, oh yes, because therefore, you know, we did the route flying, we did supply dropping in Borneo, but when you weren't doing that, then you would be what they call continuation training. So you'd be going off and doing on occasions circuits and bumps just to keep your hand in. Approaches, ADF approaches, radar approaches, cross countries, up country. So yes, a lot of training. Yeah.
Any jungle training?
Yes, went off and did the jungle survival course, which was about a week. There was a jungle survival school at Changi. That was on the east side of the airfield. So you checked in there one on a Monday morning, and they started telling you all about what to do in the jungle and what not to do in the jungle. At lunchtime, first or second day, they produced a whole load of chickens which you were supposed to kill and eat, which had the RSPCA seen the way we killed our chicken, we'd have been in dead trouble, because we none of us had any idea how to kill a chicken. But eventually we did, and got plucked and cooked, but probably quite glad to get back to the mess that night. We learned how to build shelters for the jungle, and
can you remember how to do any of that?
Well, the first, if I take you forward a bit, we then went up into the jungle, and we did again. We went walking into the jungle, and that was quite amusing, because I was quite a long way down this file of people going into the jungle, and the guy who ran it, I mean, I don't know if I should have told you, the guy who was never known as Jungle Jim, he was a squadron leader who ran it. But he was equipped with a pistol as a safety thing. And we were walking through the jungle, single file, through this sort of quite high grass. Well, it wasn't jungle at that stage, it was just this very tall grass. And the word came back, stop, 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 stop. So we all stopped. And go back, go back, go back. So he started going back, stop, 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 stop. So we all came down, so we stopped. And then we heard this odd crack, crack going on, and didn't really know what was going on. Eventually we set off again and started camping for the night. And apparently what had happened, Jungle Jim had been leading this file of people through this tall grass on the way into the jungle. And he'd come round the corner, and there was a tiger and its cub sitting there. And he was equipped with this pistol, and he thought, well, what do I do now? And this sort of tiger had looked at him. So he got out his pistol and he'd fired it into the air. And of course, about one in three shots worked, which is why. And eventually this tiger sort of got up and looked at him rather disdainfully and wandered off into the jungle with its cub. And then that's when we pressed on again. So I never saw the tiger, but apparently it was there. I don't know how many there are these days. Now, the first night we had to make stretcher beds. So you find a couple of trees the right distance apart, cut some poles, and lash these poles at the same height, each side of the tree. The only stuff you've got to live on in the jungle is parachute silk and the cord from the nylon cord. So you wrap the parachute silk around these two poles and make a stretcher bed. And if you've got time and if you've got any sense, you put a sort of another shelter, some more parachute silk over the top, because the jungle at night gets bloody cold and the water starts dripping as the dew comes. So that was that was one night, and that was quite an amusing night in many ways, because I was lying there fast awake in the middle of the night, and suddenly this blood curdling scream echoes out through the jungle, and we were quite close to each other. We weren't supposed to be close to each other, but the other guys in the crew, but we'd got there before the instructors, so we'd put our stretcher beds up fairly close to each other for a bit of company. But nobody moved. You know, all these brave young RF officers all lying there thinking, what's that? I'm not... anyway, the blood-curdling scream didn't last that long, and so we lie there and thought, well, it's not us, it's somebody else at least. And apparently what had happened was, we found out next morning, was there was an older squadron leader had come out from the Ministry of Defence, and he'd gone to bed in his stretcher bed, and he'd woken up in the morning with a snake curled around him, hence the blood-curdling scream. But of course it wasn't a snake. He'd got his arm over like that, and his arm had gone to sleep, so when he woke up he couldn't feel the arm. All he could feel was this thing wrapped around him. It's quite amusing to think of, you know, everybody lying there, and well, the instructors can deal with that, nothing to do with me. So that was one form of shelter, and then you did it as a crew. You had a lean-to. Again, it was just a question of making a base of poles and just padding it with parachute silk, and then cutting other poles that literally, you know, just lean down. It'd be about 3 or 4 feet high at the top and on the ground at the back, and just if you put those close enough, it makes a shelter. So we spent 3 days in the jungle doing that sort of thing. The only animal I ever saw was a rat, which was eating all the spare food we had, because we'd smuggled a bit more than we were supposed to. And it must be the only 3 days in Malayan jungle history where it hasn't rained. So we didn't see any leeches. Now they said, oh well, you know, told us how to get rid of leeches, you know, with burning cigarettes and iodine and all the other good things. But we never saw a leech, because, you know, it was all too dry. So we then walked out of the jungle at the end of the third day, and of course the ice cream man was there. Wherever you went in Singapore in those days, or in Malaya, the Magnolia Man, the Magnolia ice cream, and he gave me ice cream and cold drinks. And but they always knew where people were. So it was, how they did it, I don't know, but you came out of the jungle and there was the Magnolia Man waiting to serve you an ice cream after 3 days. So that was the jungle training, yes, which in my case was not very onerous. The other thing that was quite lucky was that they used to run, an escape and evasion exercise, which could be quite tough. But fortunately, they suspended that because of the Indonesian confrontation. They decided it was a bit dangerous to have people running around there chasing other people. So we were spared that. So it was fairly tame from our point of view.
And how did you meet Dorothy?
Dorothy had gone out. She went out in the January, as I went out in the October, and she was a teacher. She'd been teaching, she comes from Ormskirk, she'd been teaching in, I don't know if you want to talk to her later on, obviously, but she was teaching in Bootle, and thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think she'd done a couple of years there. She thought, well, do I want to spend the rest of my life teaching in Bootle? No, I want to go abroad and see something. So she'd applied, in fact, to the Air Force. She'd seen an advert, or somebody told her, and she'd applied to go to Ghana, and she'd gone down to London for the interviews, and they'd said, oh, well, we can't get you to Ghana, would you like to go to Singapore? And so she came out to Singapore. The mess wasn't as busy and as crowded as it was to become later on. So initially, a lot of the teachers stayed in the mess, lived in the mess, and they lived in one of the accommodation blocks round the foot of the mess. And so when I arrived in Singapore, Dorothy was living in the mess, and was teaching, say, 4 to, sorry, 7 to 11-year-olds, of which there were quite a number on the base, as I said before. And that's it, young man out there. So I came back married, which upset my mum, but there we are.
There was no problem with that. There was sort of room for marriage and.
Oh yes. I mean, well, okay. The things we put up for in those days, which you wouldn't dream of these days. We went out together for quite a long time, and Dorothy, just yes.
Yeah. When you're ready.
Right. Yes. So when I got to Singapore, yes, Dorothy was living in the mess, and. We eventually got engaged, and we indulged home to get married, which again was quite a problem because, as I said previously, there were a lot of people out in Singapore at this stage because the confrontation was had built up quite a lot, and trying to get back, and we both decided we would come home to get married because it seemed a bit unfair on parents and that not to do that. So. We decided that we would indulge home, and it was obviously the wedding was set for August 21st, in the middle of the school summer holidays. So, come the end of term, Dorothy started trying to get a flight back, which proved very difficult. But eventually, of course, living in the mess, we knew everybody, and one of the movement guys tipped us the wink that there was a Britannia flight going out. In the middle of the night. Now, normally the FIAF ticket booking officer, they call themselves, they decided who was going where and doing what. They controlled who went on it, of course. But it was at the weekend, and this flight had sort of come up quite suddenly. So, Paul, bless him, got your flight home. Got Dorothy a flight home. Yeah, so Dorothy indulged home at that stage. Then, close to the time, because I couldn't get as much leave as she had with her school summer holidays, again, I was having trouble. And then I think I set off probably on about the Sunday before we were getting married the next Saturday, and flew off to Gan, and got airborne from Gan, which for the next stop, and I fell asleep. Woke up and the sun was on the wrong side of the aeroplane, and Britannia again, and we'd lost an engine and we were going back into Gan. So we then sat on the ground at Gan waiting for a spare part to arrive, with Dorothy's parents going spare about this bridegroom they'd never met who had disappeared into nowhere, because there was no way of contacting her from Gan. There were no mobile phones and things obviously in those days. And eventually this aeroplane got working again, and I pitched up to the UK on the Wednesday before I got married on the Saturday, not having met Dorothy's parents or anybody, and my parents not having met Dorothy. So it was a fairly frantic couple of days there. But that was another example of the way governments and Air Force and things work, because in the olden days, under the old Queen, you weren't supposed to get married and if you were under 25. It wasn't approved of. And so when we were going to get married, I was 24, and you had to get the permission from the station commander, which I suppose was really a formality, but, you know, one did these things. But because I was under 25, I didn't get any marriage allowance. So... But Dorothy, who was being paid on the basis of a UK-based civilian, went back out to Singapore with me after the marriage. We were living in quite close to the base. But they said, oh no, she couldn't have her full UK-based pay because she was now my wife. The fact that she was doing exactly what she was contracted to do... and it made absolutely no difference to them at all. But they docked her money. So they got it both ways. And
you were worse off.
Yes. So, of course, these days, you know, you'd kick up a fuss and something would be done about it. But, of course, in those days, you didn't. You know, as a flight attendant, you didn't start telling wing commanders that this was wrong. And so... But, that was another just a picture of the times, that there were these rules and ways of doing things, and you certainly weren't supposed to get married under the age of 25.
Why was that?
It was just one of those things that had come through, that a young officer was supposed to devote himself to the service until he was really established in his profession, and then he could start thinking about getting married and raising a family. But you know, it wasn't really on for a young subaltern to be worrying about this sort of thing. He should be worrying about the regiment and so forth. And I think it's just one of those lovely things that's come down over the years. But
So I wonder whether the next thing might be to talk about the route flying, perhaps.
Yes, the route flying. We confrontation was a heavy load. We had a big commitment flying out to Labuan, which is up near Brunei in Borneo, which is about a 4-hour flight away. The other big commitment was to Kuching in Sarawak, which was about 2 hours away. So a lot of the days we spent getting airborne about 6 o'clock in the morning and heading on a 4-hour trip out there. And I always remember them because you got up at got airborne about 6 o'clock in the morning as the sun came up and it was shining straight in your eyes. And you'd fly 4 hours out there, a couple of hours on the ground while the thing was unloaded and loaded. 4 hours flying back again, and you got back to Changi just as the sun was setting in the west with the sun shining straight in your eyes. So that was one feature. The other feature was the intertropical conversion zone. There is an area of very bad weather, which for reasons I won't go into now, it produces a whole string right across the tropics of thunderstorms. And this moves depending on the season. In the summer, it's up towards the north, and it moves down towards the southern summer. It moves down the south. But very often, going between these places, you had to fly through it. Which on an Argosy wasn't so much trouble because you had a radar on the Argosy, but in the Hastings we didn't have any radar, so you could fly and avoid this thing for so long, but at some stage if it was on your route you had to go through it because you had to get to Labuan, and so that could be quite fun going because you just pointed at the nearest cloud and hope you'd found a bit that wasn't too bumpy, and you'd head through it. And so we had some quite, I mean, probably worse for the passengers down the back, because it must have been horrendous down the back, because they weren't the most comfortable aeroplanes anyway. But being thrown around by these, in the bottom of these thunderstorms, because we flew at about 10,000 feet most of the time, which is towards the base of these thunderstorms. And that could be, I mean, again, at the age of 24, it's all hijinks, isn't it? But it can't have been nice for the passengers. And the other thing was that we had a DV window, a direct view window, which you could open. But this wasn't strictly waterproof, so you'd fly along with your right knee absolutely soaking wet with all the thunderstorm rain coming through that window and coming around the edges of it and dripping in. So that was the bread and butter route flying, if you like, just taking supplies and people backs and forwards to Borneo, because the strategic transport, the Comets and the Britannias, would bring it out to Changi, and then we'd take it on to in general, and we take it on into Borneo. The other route flying was Hong Kong. Again, we were sort of supplying them with the Kai Tak, with their bits and pieces, and moving people up and down there. And that was quite fun, because we could go up to Hong Kong. We had to stop on the way, because when you get to Hong Kong, it's shorter diversions, so you have to stop and pick up fuel on the way. And we used to stop in Saigon, and this was the